Hello, fellow Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to a new edition of my Old Kentucky Podcast. My name is Robert Connie, and joining me, as always, is Jasmine Smith. Jasmine, how are you today?
I'm doing good, Robert. I actually got to witness some history this afternoon.
Oh, yeah?
I just got back from the investiture, so the formal swearing in of Chief Judge Denise Clayton. She's the first African-American Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals of Kentucky.
Yeah, I saw that on Twitter. That was awesome.
I got to go to that. That was really cool.
Congratulations to her. Huge milestone. And yeah, I'm really, really excited to see what she's going to do. The judicial branch plays into our show pretty substantially, Jasmine.
Yes, they do.
We have some information, some news about the pension lawsuit, which was decided today, June 20th in Franklin Circuit Court. We're going to talk about the Medicaid lawsuit, which is in federal court, but we're going to talk about it too. Jasmine's going to talk to us about Marcy's Law, an update about that and how it's going to potentially be challenged on the ballot. And we have some information about sports betting, which we've talked about before, but there is now some movement in Kentucky around that. And also, we spoke to Emily Ferguson just before we started recording here. She is a candidate for the 72nd district. It's around Lexington. It's just northeast of Lexington. She is running for Sandy Overly's current seat. Yeah, that conversation went really well. We're really happy to share it with you guys. But yes, without any further ado, let's talk about the stuff that we have to talk about today. Jasmine, the huge news on the pension front.
Right. This is breaking news.
Breaking news. Yes. This is decided today. Today is June the 20th. This happened this afternoon in Franklin Circuit Court. Judge Philip Shepard ruled that Senate Bill 151, the pension/sewage bill, was unconstitutional. So there were several challenges to the bill that were made by Attorney General Andy Beshear and his friends, but the ones that were most persuasive to Judge Philip were that the bill did not receive enough readings and that the bill did not pass with enough votes. So, you know, those are some major things. There were other issues that were not necessarily about procedure that there were also challenges to the bill about, but those two that I just mentioned there were the most persuasive. So, Jasmine, as a reminder, the legislature requires bills to have three readings before they can be voted upon. This is in the Constitution. You have to do this. While the sewage bill, that was the original bill, Senate Bill 151, it did actually receive three readings before the legislature. But then the bill was, you know, gutted and replaced by the pension bill, and it had like one reading in front of the House and none in front of the Senate at all. Judge Shepard said that those couldn't count. You know, you can't count these other readings that were of a bill that wasn't actually a bill. You can't count those as readings. And in his opinion, he cited at length the debate around the writing of the 1891 Kentucky Constitution, which sought to prevent this exact behavior by including the three readings provision. This was a comment that Judge Shepard quoted that I think is kind of relevant. This is from somebody at the Constitutional Convention. Quote, whenever a man wants to pass anything that is wrong, he tries to keep it from being printed. He tries to keep its contents unknown, unquote. So yeah, there you go.
Ooh.
Yes, that is what happened, right? It was gutted and replaced by a bill and nobody could read it. And before we knew it, it was already passed. So the governor and the legislature, they contended that Senate Bill 151 did not appropriate money because, and the reason they said that it didn't appropriate any money is because that bills that appropriate money require 51 votes in the House to pass, and Senate Bill 151 received 49. So here are some relevant quotes about that subject from Judge Shepard. Quote, in the current case, Senate Bill 151 plainly appears to be a bill for the appropriation of money. Plainly appears to be a bill. So that's pretty strong language. I don't know. I don't read a lot of opinions. It seemed pretty strong language to me. and then another quote. In addition, Section 46 mandates a majority vote for bills creating a debt. A debt is, in its simplest terms, a financial obligation or liability. In fact, in the current case, the governor has repeatedly referred to the pension program as an unfunded liability. This characterization is certainly accurate. The Commonwealth remains financially obligated to its public employees, despite the insolvency of the pension fund. Senate Bill 151 continues to impose that financial obligation, though under altered terms. So, yes, Judge Philip Shepard said, hey, this does create a debt. This does appropriate money. Therefore, it needed 51 votes to pass, which it did not receive. Therefore, it is not passed.
And you literally called it a liability.
Yes, you called it a liability, you dummy. That's really funny. Right, so because this bill is unconstitutional on procedural grounds, Judge Shepard did not rule about whether or not the contents of the bill violate the inviolable contract or any other matter actually within the bill.
And this happens all the time. You get these great lawsuits on a novel issue and you lawyers are excited about, you know, what the judge is going to rule and what kind of precedent's going to be set. And then they reverse something on something procedural.
Well, honestly, Jasmine, I hear what you're saying, but I kind of almost feel like this is a flip-flopped. I think the procedure itself was the more novel case. You know, what does it mean to hollow out a bill and replace it with something else? Can you do that? Can you pass a bill with 49? Because, I mean, what the government was basically saying, and this goes there goes more into the opinion, but he says, you know, the governor is like, hey, the legislature itself is the group that gets to decide whether it had enough votes to pass. Like, the legislature writes its own rules about whether or not a bill should actually have passed, or whether it needed 51 or just a majority or just a plurality of votes. He was like, no. And he actually goes and quotes Marbury versus Madison, which I feel like
that's like case number one,
right?
In
exactly
law school, you know.
Yeah, that's like, I mean, you don't cite Marbury versus Madison unless you're trying to make a big point, because I feel like most lawyers, like, and even me, roll your eyes at that, like,
yeah,
come on now. But yeah, he's making this big point about judicial review and the importance of it. So I think, like, the procedure here is almost more interesting to me than the content itself.
Yeah, you're definitely right. It definitely makes some changes. The legislature's gonna have to change how they, you know, if this gets upheld, how they've been passing bills over the last several years. But the merits, I think, are really interesting, too, because
right, that's true.
Whether that violates the inviolable contract, I also thought is a really interesting issue. But I do think this definitely, you know, this isn't just a individual case thing. This is something that is going to have an effect on how bills are passed in the future.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I mean, I think it's interesting he didn't strike down the fact that they gutted a bill and then replaced it, because, like, that needs to happen because of Kentucky's way that we have, like, a filing deadline for bills. You know, that's still kosher as long as you then read it and take 5 days to actually pass the bill.
Right.
Like, you can still do that as long as you actually read the bill. So anyways, Jasmine, the upshot of this is that the case is definitely not going to be appealed by the Bevin administration, and they are going to try to appeal directly to the Supreme Court, Skokie, and skip the appellate level, which I think they'll probably get.
Skipping the first appellate level.
Okay. I didn't
the
go
court
to
of appeals.
The court of skipping the court of, yes, that's right, because it's still technically an appeal.
The
I
Supreme
gotcha.
Court is, well, definitely an appellate court.
The court of appeals, skipping the court of appeals. All right, Jasmine, tell us about Marcy's Law.
All right, so one of the first bills passed in this past legislative session with very little opposition was Marcy's Law, the Crime Victims Bill of Rights. But as we discussed on the podcast, it's a law that has to be voted on in November because it would be a constitutional amendment. So this is the language that Kentuckians will see on their ballot. It will say, are you in favor of providing constitutional rights to victims of crime, including the right to be treated fairly, with dignity and respect, and the right to be informed and to have a voice in the judicial process? Who's going to say no to that question, right?
That's ridiculous, yeah.
So, you know, this question that's going to be on the ballot says nothing about what all the law actually includes, or that there's no funding mechanism or anything like that.
Right, there's all kinds of stuff to not like about the law or about the bill. You can listen to our podcast about it where you went into detail about that, yeah.
Right, so there's an organization called the Kentucky Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. So their president, David Ward, says that they plan to sue because the language in the ballot question is too vague, and it also doesn't adequately represent the changes that will be made to the Constitution. Mr. Ward also says that the right to sue and hire an attorney to represent personal interests also creates an equal protection issue, because this could mean that lower income victims wouldn't be able to afford to hire a private attorney and wouldn't have that same privilege that people with more economic means have. So that's kind of a couple arguments that they plan to make in this lawsuit. So ballot questions have been challenged before, but a lot of those challenges have been about whether the question addresses more than one subject.
Huh, okay.
I think State Senator Whitney Westerfield made comments about this, and he was like, you know, I would have put the whole bill in there if I could, but I think this question speaks for exactly what the bill seeks to do.
Right.
I'd kind of be surprised if this suit is successful. I do think the question is vague, but maybe just specific enough. Judges don't really want to interfere with the democratic process.
Right.
So I don't know.
Right. Okay. That's interesting. When you talked about it, you talked about how kind of there was a lot of redundancy in here, and it creates a lot of unfunded situations where we're having a lot of problems. Like,
The big part is the standing to sue.
Right. Yeah, and that's not in here, I don't think.
It doesn't really say the only thing that might be a mention to that is the having a voice in the judicial process. But we already had a statute that included most of the things in the law, but now we have a right to sue that can really clog up proceedings and, and, you know, maybe keep people incarcerated for longer periods of time waiting to try to give notice to alleged victims. So there's all kinds of difficulty, but you know, this is a question that I don't think a lot of just your average people are going to say no to on their ballot. But if you've listened to my old Kentucky podcast, you've heard about the problems with Marcy's Law and you'll know what to do.
Well, yeah. And I don't know, man. I think with the text like that, you're going to have trouble getting anybody to vote against it.
No.
All right, Jasmine, I'm going to talk a little bit about the Kentucky's Medicaid program. We've talked about the trials, the court cases about the Medicaid program waiver. On Friday, June the 15th, the Kentucky Medicaid waiver actually had its day in court. Go listen to our show with Kara Stewart to learn a lot more about what's actually included in the case, about the waiver itself and the suits that are about it. You should definitely do that if you're not informed about it already, but we have a lot of information about that. But this is about the specific court case that was actually heard about the waiver. So according to watchers and media reports, things are actually looking pretty good for the petitioner. So go, Kara. Here's a quote from a Modern Healthcare article, which Modern Healthcare is a publication that's mostly about the healthcare industry and healthcare public policy issues. Quote, Judge Boasberg did not appear to agree with HHS's assertion that Medicaid's aim is to serve the health and well-being of low-income individuals by improving their quality of life and possibly moving them out of poverty, unquote. So the person who said that was Elliot Fishman, who Elliot Fishman handled 1115 waivers for the Obama administration, and he was talking about specifically what the, like the government was like, oh, you know, the whole point of Medicaid is actually to improve people's quality of life. The petitioners themselves are saying, no, the point of Medicaid is to give people health care. Right. So there you go. So that's the crux of the argument. Medicaid exists to expand access to health care, and that's it. So the government's argument for Kentucky seemed to center around the fact that Matt Bevin has threatened to throw everyone off of expanded Medicaid if he does not get his way. So basically, there's another really good quote from the article. Quote, by implementing work requirements and other waiver provisions, more people will maintain Medicaid coverage than is if the expansion is repealed, unquote. So that's basically like, because this threat exists, changing this to have fewer people have Medicaid actually increases the number of people that will have Medicaid because the governor says he's going to just cancel it otherwise, which is completely ridiculous. I mean, in my mind, that's just completely ridiculous. Mm-hmm. That's a little bit like, feels a little bit like President Trump in the baby jails this week with like, yeah, no, which is a horrible, horrible thing. But like, it feels a little bit like that because it's like, I have this policy, but it's up to you. Like, do you, like you have to give me what I want in order to have anything at all. Holding issues hostage like this is something that they're actually trying to use in a court of law. So the judge has said that he expects to rule before the end of June, which is coming like in 10 days. And any decision will definitely be appealed by the losing side. But whoever wins on this level is actually, I think, really important to Kentuckians. So if the government wins, the petitioners have to get a stay to prevent the law from being implemented. The waiver will be implemented unless they get a stay at the next level. But if the government loses, it brings the process to a halt. So basically it's like, okay, no more implementation, just keep going as it was before, and the appeal can be ongoing. Unless you win, this won't actually get implemented because we're ready to have this waiver start to be implemented very soon, and it would definitely overlap with the time that this would actually be moving up the chain. All right, well, that's Medicaid waiver stuff. So we'll be definitely keeping you informed before this is decided, which may be before our next show. Who knows? Jasmine, you talked to us a little bit about sports gambling and the decision at the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and we talked a little bit about whether that would actually make its way to Kentucky, and it looks like it has, at least on some level. So 9 members of the state legislature are looking to expand sports betting in Kentucky. We talked about the Supreme Court decision a few weeks ago. Again, the Supreme Court decision, what it did, it gave the authority to states to legalize sport gambling at the state level. So when we did that show, we wondered if any Kentuckians would actually write a bill. So the 9 folks who are joining forces are Jason Nemus, John Sims, Julie Rackey Adams, Morgan McGarvey, Diane St. Ange, Kim Mosier, George Brown, Dean Shamor, and Julian Carroll. So that group actually, I mean, I'm sure you were counting in your head, Jasmine, but that group includes 5 Democrats and 4 Republicans, 6 House members and 3 senators.
That's a pretty solid group.
Yeah, it's a nice cross-section of basically everybody. Then geographically, 3 are members are from Louisville, two are from Northern Kentucky. One is from Lexington. One is from Frankfort. One is from Northeastern Kentucky, like Flemingsburg. And one is from like just west of Louisville, Hardinsburg. So when we talked about the show originally, we talked about like an urban-rural divide, but maybe it was more of like Eastern Kentucky and the cities versus Western Kentucky. And this is kind of borne out in my mind because nobody is from west of Bowling Green. And even though, Jasmine, Western Kentucky University is in Bowling Green, but if you talk to anybody from Western Kentucky, they will tell you.
That's not Western Kentucky.
Yes, that's very true. So few details of what the bill would include were actually released during this press conference. That makes sense, though. You know, they're just announcing that they're thinking about it. They aren't actually writing a bill yet. But there were some details about what would not be included in a bill in Kentucky. So they did say that while they were open to limited betting on college sports, but no betting on high school or below. So Jasmine, you couldn't place a $2,000 bet on your cousin's middle school basketball team.
I think that's fair.
Yeah, I think that that's fair too. I honestly would be in favor of like banning betting on college sports, but I don't think that that would fly here in old Kentucky, where college sports basically run the show in terms of what people would want to bet on. So Jason Nemes, who is, he's a representative from Louisville, and he's kind of leading the charge here, one of the people leading the charge, in my opinion, along with Morgan McGarvey. He said he was not a fan of using the bill as a dedicated revenue stream. So that would mean that the revenue that was generated by this program would only go towards education or pensions or something like really specific. But he said if that was the only way to get a bill to pass, he would still vote for it. So, and the reason that that's important is because last session, Julian Carroll, who's in this group, he sponsored a bill which would have legalized sports betting and included a dedicated revenue stream for pensions and education. So that's why they talked about that. With a group of legislators that's clearly interested in moving forward with a bill, there will definitely be a bill in Kentucky. That's now pretty much for sure. But the biggest hurdle next year becomes, I think, a committee assignment. So the bill would be eligible to be introduced in, either chamber, because you've got people in either chamber who are on this group. Right now, Diane St. Ange is the chair of the Small Business and IT and the IT Committee, and Julie Racky Adams is the chair of the Senate Healthcare Committee. I don't think the Healthcare Committee would get this bill. Maybe the Small Business and IT Committee, but I'm not sure about that either. Committee chairmanships are all up for reassignment after the next election, and nobody really knows what's going to happen in November, so we could have like all new chairmanships, or Jason Nemes could get a chairmanship. Maybe the Democrats take over, and some of the Democrats in this group would get the chairmanships. So, what committee it goes to becomes really important, and also getting buy-in from leadership to get it assigned to a committee that's favorable to get this bill out of it. Regardless, it's likely that this bill is going to see a lot of attention next year. It'll be one of these odd number sessions, shorter time, but less budget stuff. So it's stuff like this does kind of come up and become a bunch of news. So we're definitely moving forward on that.
Good. I'm glad we are.
Yeah. You talked a lot about this. I don't know. We'll be interesting to see how it all moves forward. All right, Jasmine, we're going to talk to Emily Ferguson. Yeah, I'm excited about it. So here it is.
Emily Ferguson is the Democratic nominee for the 72nd District of the Kentucky House of Representatives. District 72 covers Bourbon, Bath, and Nicholas counties, as well as a little portion of Fayette County. The seat is currently represented by Sandy Overly, who's retiring at the end of her term. Ms. Ferguson is a lawyer who works as a policy advisor for the Democratic Caucus in the House of Representatives. So, Emily Ferguson, welcome to My Old Kentucky Podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's talk about how you ended up running for this seat. So the story's pretty interesting. Representative Overly didn't announce that she was retiring until the filing deadline, and then she was with you as your candidacy papers were filed. So tell us how you ended up running for this seat in the 72nd.
Well, I've worked with Representative Overly for the past few years, both on the campaign trail and in her legislative office. So I've spent a lot of time traveling not only throughout our district but the state, and I've been doing a lot of the behind the scenes work with helping constituents and helping work on projects that arise throughout the 72nd. So although I've never really, to be honest, envisioned myself as being kind of the front face and running for office myself, when she came and told me that she decided she wasn't going to run, I just sort of felt this almost not a calling, but I just felt in my heart that I needed to step up and continue her work and to be a strong voice for the district so that I could keep sort of our work, really, because I'd been with her for so long that I felt like, and I live in the community as well, so it was my community, it was my district just as much as it was hers, and it was just important to me to keep the work going.
Yeah, so that was kind of my next question, whether, you know, you've thought about this for a long time or whether it was more of a recent desire. So I guess what you're saying is that once she said she was retiring, that's when you really felt called to do that?
Right. Like, I've always provided support work and done the research, you know, sort of done everything that it takes to be a state representative.
Right.
And I've provided assistance to multiple state representatives around the state, but I never saw myself, I just never really thought about it, to be honest, about actually running. But being in Frankfort and witnessing firsthand a lot of the concerning behavior and the harmful policies that we've been seeing over the past couple mm-hmm. years, it just kind of felt like it was time to stand up and put my name on the ballot and try to make a positive difference as we were trying to fight to restore a more transparent process and provide funding for education and secure the pensions for our public employees. There's just so much work to do, and I really felt like kind of had to put my money where my mouth was.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about your district. So Representative Overly served in District 72 for 5 terms. She defeated Republicans in 3 of her elections to that seat. So the 72nd is a pretty rural district. The biggest city is Paris in Bourbon County. And the demographics of that seat look similar to a lot of seats that Republicans picked up in 2016. So why do you think that Representative Overly was so successful in holding that district for Democrats? And are you trying to follow a similar strategy or, you know, doing your own thing, doing something a little different?
Well, I think everyone knows that Representative Overly is a role model and a mentor of mine. And so I've learned a lot from her example. Having watched her and spent time with her, I've seen that compassion and determination are invaluable qualities that a leader must possess. And I've watched her work for the families of our district. She's responsive, she's present, and she treats her voters like family. So when they have a problem, she doesn't stop until she fixes it or finds a way to try to help them at least a little bit. And I think that's why the members or the constituents of the 72nd District have continued to elect her for the past 10 mm-hmm. years. And that's the kind of representative that I want to be as I go forward. I wouldn't really call it a strategy, but I'm trying to follow her example on how a candidate and a representative should behave. And I'm trying to treat my campaign like I intend to treat my job when I'm elected as state representative. So I'm just going and I'm working really hard. I'm trying to spend time at every event I can go to. I'm trying to get to know every single person I have the opportunity to meet. And I'm trying to learn as much as possible about the needs that every corner of the 72nd District has. And I think that it's vital that a person that's trying to represent their district is active in that district. And I plan to continue hitting every event and taking every phone call and being available 24/7 to my constituents.
So it sounds like it's kind of like an accessibility thing then?
Right. I think it's about being there and being involved and hearing. You're there to represent your friends and neighbors and the people that live down the road from you. And how can you represent them if you're not there and you don't hear what their concerns are and hear their feedback on things that are going on in the community and in the state? And I really think it's just about being involved and being available and letting them know that you're there and that I give my phone number on radio ads online. I'm here. Call me. You know, that's my motto is I'm here. Just let me know what I can do to help you. And I think that people appreciate that.
All right, cool. So for the past several years, Republicans in the House have pointed out the young age of their caucus relative to the Democratic caucus. However, this year, Democrats are running several candidates who are significantly younger. So, you know, as someone who has just finished law school a few years ago, do you see yourself focusing on any issues that you think have been overlooked by some of the older legislators in the past?
Well, I'm excited to be running with an energetic and engaged slate of Democrat leaders across Kentucky. And I'm really excited that we have all of these fresh faces and particularly the historic number of women that are running
yeah.
positions in the legislature. And so I'm really excited to be among that group as well. But I think that regardless of age, Kentucky's challenges are the same. And we have to all work together to try to find solutions such as funding public education and a permanent source of funding for the pension system. And I hope that younger, new people that are coming to the legislature will maybe bring some different perspectives and some innovative solutions. But I'm excited to be running with people of all ages and all groups. I think it takes us all. And I think there's a lot to be learned from the more established older members. And I think there's a lot to be learned from people that have, never been involved in politics or government before. I think that sort of the nature of the General Assembly is the goal is to have a mixture of of different experiences and different types of people so that you can all come together and really have democracy in action.
Yeah. So let's talk a little about some of the people that came before you. So during your campaign, you know, you've made mentions of your mentors and you've already talked with us about Representative Overly's mentorship. And you've also had fundraisers sponsored by Leslie Combs, Kelly Flood, Martha Wayne Collins, Rodkey Adkins, and several others. So tell us about the public servants that have influenced you.
Well, of course, Representative Overly is who I've worked the closest with over the years. But during my time in Frankfort, I've also been exposed to so many members of the caucus, the Senate caucus, the past governors, past legislators, and they've all had a really big impact on me professionally and showed me, you know, kind of the ins and outs of Frankfort. But former Lieutenant Governor Crit Lew Allen is sort of, to me, the gold standard of honest, ethical leadership. And I think she gave Pittsford a really good example of how government officials should work for the people and they should use the government to benefit people. And I think she's been just watching her work over the past several years before she retired is one of my strongest influences. And then, of course, I've had the honor of working for former leader Rodkey Adkins until I resigned recently. And so when I worked for him and for Sandy, I was working as a policy advisor and attorney for the House Caucus. And I got to spend a lot of time with members that were leaving, past members that come up to visit, and, of course, the current members. And I feel like, and even really, even members from on the other side of the aisle, I have some, you know, some fairly good friends that are not part of the Democratic Caucus. And I feel like I've been exposed and been able to gain a lot of knowledge and experience of not just their political knowledge and, you know, the process and how it works, but really one of the biggest things that I think has helped me in working for the Democratic Caucus is that I was helping legislators that were from Paducah and Pikeville and Ashland and everywhere in between. And so I feel like I have a really broad base of knowledge and sort of geographically things that affect everyone, because when you're representing someone your district in Frankfort, you're really not just representing your district. You know, your vote, yes, you're voting for your people, but you're also voting for all of the other citizens across Kentucky because every law affects everyone. So I think that sort of the caucus as a whole has really done a lot for me in just the broad base of information that I got and the experiences and just hearing things and helping get their constituents from across the state as a whole has really been.
You know, you mentioned in your answer there about your work as a policy advisor to the House and the Democratic Caucus inside the House. So, I mean, I'm really interested to know what that was like this particular session. You know, there was so much legislation that was revealed and then immediately voted on. And that's, you know, obviously that's gone into the courts now. And I think we have a decision on that today. But what was it like during the legislative session? Was it difficult to keep your head above water?
It really was, and there's always, every session is always crammed full of, you know, so many important policy things that are happening. But this session seemed to be the worst that anyone had really seen in a while. Of course, I did not file to run until the last day, so that was the end of January. I continued to work with the caucus until the end of February to give them time to find a replacement, and then I resigned. But although I was not there every day, I was still obviously following very closely everything that was going on. But in the time that I was there and what I witnessed, it was one of the most chaotic sessions that I had really been a part of. And I think that really in the 2 years since the GOP has gained control of the House, their process of secrecy and their inability to reach across the aisle, the exclusion of the public, and the producing bills that don't comply with statutes or the Constitution shows that they just don't know how to run a government. And to me, that is not how democracy is designed to work. So it was really disappointing to watch the rank-and-file members of their party who stood by and allowed their leadership to do those things. And when I'm elected, I will not let leadership, whether it's Republican or Democrat, run amok. I'm a Democrat, but I'm first and foremost, I'm a Kentuckian. And I think that we all need to remember at the end of the day that we're all Kentuckians and we need to work together. And for democracy to work, everyone needs a seat at the table. We need to listen. We don't need to lock people out of committee rooms. We don't need to pass bills at midnight. I think we need to listen to and value people that we represent. And I think that we saw that today when Judge Shepard's opinion ruled Senate Bill 151, a.k.a. the sewage bill, unconstitutional due to the process. I think that was what everyone was concerned about this whole time. I think even people that didn't have anything to do with the pensions or weren't concerned about that saw still an issue with just the way things were handled, because it may not be your issue today, but it could be your issue tomorrow. And I think that you know, today was a real triumph just for the process and democracy as a whole.
Absolutely. Yeah. As we've talked to so many different Democratic candidates for the House throughout this, you know, election season, it's just been repeated over and over again, the issue of process and of following, you know, regular order in order to pass bills. And that's really good. And I think that's something that the Democratic caucus should be able to hang its hat on in the future. And I hope that, you know, as you guys all get elected and move into Frankfort, that continues to be a forefront in everybody's mind. So I'm glad to hear you say that. But your campaign, it seems to be honing in on the issue of public education. So I'm actually on your email list. I don't live in your district, but I'm on your email list. And I've seen like several of your emails come across about public education. So what are some policy changes that you would like to see around public education? And why is this issue so important to you?
Well, public education is really one of the central focuses of my campaign. You're right. I'm the proud product of Bourbon County's public education system. And I wouldn't be where I am today if I hadn't had access to a quality public education. And that's a big part of why I decided to run after watching what happened the previous session with charter schools and just sort of seeing these attacks, you know, coming on the horizon. I feel like it was sort of my duty as having received such a quality public education and then been able to go to UK Law School to fight to ensure that every child throughout Kentucky had the same opportunities that I was given. While working with the General Assembly, I was there firsthand, and I saw from the front lines this attack that the majority party has been waging on public education. And what we have now is an administration and a legislature that supports taking tax dollars from our public schools and sending them to for-profit charter schools. And they're now they're looking to do a state takeover of JCPS, which is our state's largest public school system. And I'm sure that we can see school vouchers on the horizon. I think that is very important to me. I think the first thing we need to do is repeal the charter school legislation so we can prevent more siphoning of public school dollars for private education with vouchers. And I think that we need revenue fixes for adequate funding of public education. We need to fix and stabilize our pension system. And we need to expand early childhood and preschool education in Kentucky. Research shows that children who have adequate preschool education are the same children who are succeeding in first grade, sixth grade, and all the way through high school. So I think this is a wise investment for our state's resources and time to repair the damage that's been done over the past few years and start expanding public education rather than trying to constrict it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we had Josie Raymond on, who's the candidate in the 31st in Jefferson County, and she actually said that early childhood would be the first bill that she wanted to sponsor. So maybe you guys could go in on that together. That would be a great, great bill.
It would be great.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we've just come out of a budget session in Frankfort with several crazy twists and turns. But at the end of the session, there was a 6.25% cut to most agencies, major changes to the public pension system, which may or may not be, we'll see what the Supreme Court has to say about those, and also piecemeal changes to the tax system. In 2018, the Kentucky budget was not one that, you know, did well by its citizens. So in terms of, you know, process and policy, you know, you've talked about process already, but just in terms of policy, how do you hope that Kentucky changes the way that it does its business around the budget in 2020?
Well, like we've discussed, we've talked about how unfair the process was to voters and those impacted, and the lack of transparency and the lack of citizen involvement. And like you said, the session just didn't go well. And we as leaders, we have an obligation to do better. And when I'm elected, regardless of which party's in control, I would not support a process that doesn't comply with the rules of the chamber, the Kentucky statutes, or the Kentucky Constitution. I think as lawmakers, we also have an obligation to follow the law. And I will work for a process that's open, and open input, and it's transparent and comprised of timely filed bills so that people have time to read them and come to public hearings and get be on the record and be heard and just participate in the democratic process. So I've really never witnessed a scenario like what occurred last session. So I hope that I'm going to get to serve in the legislature for many years to come and that I'm able to help prevent scenarios like this from happening again.
Absolutely. So one of the things that we've been asking everybody is about what was HB 29 in the last session, which is Jim Wayne's tax reform bill that grew out of the Blue Ribbon Commission that was put in place by the Bashir administration. We think revenue is a super important issue. That's something that Kentucky has got to deal with. And you know, even though a lot of the pieces of HB 29 were kind of piecemeal implemented this year, the whole of the tax structure really needs to be overhauled. So, you know, we've been asking everybody, would you be willing to co-sponsor a bill like that that would change Kentucky's tax structure and give us more revenue to implement better and more important projects and policies in the budget next time?
Yes, not necessarily House Bill 29. I would have to read it. Things were so hectic during session, I honestly didn't get to spend a lot of time reading the bills that weren't being heard. So I don't want to make a statement on that bill in particularly, but yes, I very much support going through, looking at tax, doing comprehensive tax reform, looking at loopholes, you know, is it $12, $13 billion that we give out in tax loopholes each year that, you know, some of them are probably outdated. That would help raise revenue. I'm also open to having conversations. I think it's important that we do so about raising a more permanent form of revenue for things such as our pension system and to fund public education. And I think that we need to start having some conversations about, you know, there's lots of things being thrown out from all the way from medical marijuana to gaming to, you know, there's options. And I think that it's important that we all have a conversation about it and that everyone has a seat at the table and that we start making some decisions that help our state and that everyone can get on board with that are, you know, bipartisan in nature and try to move forward and actually be productive rather than just putting Band-Aids on it that aren't really helping those.
Absolutely. We talked about education and we talked about financial issues, but tell us about some other issues that you're particularly passionate about.
I think that something that's really important in my district, and I think most districts throughout the state, are people want more good-paying jobs. And part of something that ties in with that is, of course, the drug epidemic and access to health care. And I think that everything really goes hand in hand, and it all comes back to education as well. I mean, I think that we need to take a holistic approach in how we're helping people and the tools that we're giving people to succeed and to have fulfilling, hopeful, you know, quality lives. And I think that it's all interconnected, and I think it's really important that we give people opportunity to educate themselves, and not necessarily college, you know, vocational programs, just giving people the tools that they can go and find good paying jobs in their community, healthcare, so that they're not worried about bankruptcy and things if they get sick. And I mean, we need people to be able to advance themselves rather than living paycheck to paycheck. And so I think it comes down to access to good paying jobs and access to healthcare and treatment for the drug epidemic, so that jobs are willing to locate to our community, improve the economies throughout the state.
Yeah. Building a system that can help people live more full and more meaningful lives. That seems like a good idea.
Right.
Yeah. So if people wanted to, how could they get involved in your campaign?
Well, they can look me up on Facebook at Emily Ferguson for State Representative. They could go to my website, which is FergusonForKentucky.com. And there's a contact button there where they can volunteer or sign up for emails or signs or anything they need. Or I'm happy to give my phone number to them if anyone wants to call, 859-707-1168. Like I said, I believe in being available and accessible, so I'm open to anyone that wants to call and offer their opinion, their advice, talk to me, volunteer, preferably. Basically, all of that information is also on my website, so that would be the best place to find it.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining us today on My Old Kentucky Podcast.
Thank you.
Jasmine, how can people get a hold of us?
They can follow us on Twitter at @MyOldKYPod. They can like our Facebook page, and you can find our podcast on the podcasting app of your choice. And our two newer things that we have a newsletter that is weekly that you can subscribe to on tinyletter.com/myoldkentuckynewsletter. And of course, we have a Patreon page. So through Patreon, you can sponsor us by committing to as little as $1 a month to support our creation. And that is at patreon.com/myoldkentuckypodcast.
All right, everybody. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.